can't start a process until you filed the permit.
Frustrated lawmakers push the Pebble Mine proposal's CEO for answers on their process. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, competing views on whether the state's new gas line proposal can work.
As a state and as a project, we need to hit that window.
A lot of people get hurt jumping through windows that aren't open.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. With a rich curriculum from art to advanced engineering, over 10,000 alumni strong, 90% of their students go on to a four-year college or other post-secondary education. Explore your talents and develop your dreams at Mount Edgecombe High School. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
The proposed Pebble Mine was Exhibit A at a hearing in the U.S. House this morning. The EPA took steps to block the Southwest Alaska Mine, even though Pebble Partnership hasn't applied for permits yet. The Republican-led hearing was supposed to be a critical look at environmental regulation, but the focus shifted as lawmakers of both parties kept asking the same question. Why hasn't Pebble filed for its permits already? APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Dillingham's Kimberly Williams, director of an anti-mine group called Nunumta Auluxtai, says EPA did not act prematurely to block the mine. She testified that the threat of the project has hung over the region's economy for years.
And so for us, it has created some risk in our fishery. It has created anxiety, has created, you know, why should I invest in the fishery? Why should my children invest in this fishery in Bristol Bay? Because there may be risks that come down.
Pebble CEO Tom Collier told the House Resources Committee that his company has been treated unfairly. But several lawmakers said he could set the project on a more normal regulatory path by applying for environmental permits. Here's Representative Debbie Dingell, a Michigan Democrat.
But you can't start a process until you file the permit. This is all part
that.
Of making it go forward.
Congresswoman,
so
I so respect your view and particularly your late husband's on this issue.
That was a bit of a gaffe by Collier. Dingell's husband isn't dead, just old and retired from Congress. But asked repeatedly, Collier had a range of answers for why he hadn't filed for the permits yet.
You wouldn't want us to file if we learned that there was another possible environmental risk that we should investigate before we file. You wouldn't want us to file if we didn't have the money to go forward because there was a market change. For the last 2.5 years, Congressman, we haven't filed because of EPA's action.
EPA's action against the mine is on hold due to a legal challenge. Still, Collier says the agency's move has made it hard to attract investors. He says Pebble has already spent $750 million preparing to file for permits, and nothing in law requires them to apply before they're ready. And Collier says talk about the project's alleged risks to the environment is uninformed. The CEO says no one knows the scope or details of the current proposal.
Were we to file an application today, were I to file an application, be a dramatically different project from what has been talked about in the past.
A Democratic congressman, Ruben Gallego of Arizona, suggested another reason for the delay, Collier's bonus. Company documents show Pebble will pay its CEO $12.5 million if he can get a Corps of Engineers permit within 4 years of applying. Collier's bonus would drop to $7.5 million if it takes 6 years. Collier says it's not a reward for delaying the application, just for getting it right.
Yes, I am incentivized to submit such a airtight permit application that the process goes through relatively promptly.
Alaska Congressman Don Young spoke only briefly at the start of the hearing, and he was uncharacteristically subdued.
My position on this is if this affects state land, That's very important.
If the Pebble Mine is a choice between tapping an enormous gold and copper deposit or protecting the world's greatest red salmon run, Young isn't choosing. Not from that menu.
You take away the rights of the state without due process, it sometimes is questionable. It's not federal land. There's a difference there.
Young is a former chairman of the Resources Committee, but he didn't chair this hearing and he didn't stay for much of it. Steve Lindbeck, a Democrat hoping to unseat Young, says that was an insult to Alaskans. Young's spokesman said the congressman had another hearing to attend on commercial space launches. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The state is considering a dramatically different approach in its effort to build a natural gas pipeline. After more than 2 years of working with the big three North Slope oil companies, state officials are proposing Alaska take a larger stake or complete control of the project. And that plan is raising some eyebrows. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rachel Waldholtz has more.
Let's start with a reminder that the Alaska LNG project, as currently planned, is massive. People working on it call it a giga project, a giant gas treatment plant on the North Slope, an 800-mile pipeline down to Cook Inlet, and then a huge liquefaction facility in Nikiski, all to fulfill the decades-long dream of tapping the state's gas reserves and getting it to market. Estimates have pegged the cost at $45 to $65 billion. Under the current plan, the state would split that cost with its three partners, ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips. So the question becomes, if the state takes full ownership, who would pay? Keith Meyer is the new president of the state-owned Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. He says, not Alaska.
Just because the state owns more doesn't mean it has to invest more.
The idea is to bring in outside investors to finance the project, anyone from big customers in Asia to large pension funds. Meyer says the change was prompted by discussions with the state's partners this winter when the three companies indicated that with low oil prices cutting into their cash flow, they might not be ready to move ahead next year as planned. I asked Meyer if anyone wanted to pull out entirely.
Pull out, I would say no. Change the pace of investment, yes. But everybody, without exception, wants this project to happen.
But Meyer says the administration sees any delay as potentially fatal. Right now, the LNG, or liquefied natural gas, market is oversaturated, with prices a fraction of what they were a few years ago. But many analysts predict that oversupply will subside by the early 2020s. When it does, Meyer says, the state needs to be ready. Or competing projects will fill the void.
We need, as a state and as a project, we need to hit that window. We need to be in service in that window.
A lot of people get hurt jumping through windows that aren't open.
That's Larry Persley, an oil and gas advisor to the Kenai Peninsula Borough and longtime observer of the state's pipeline efforts. Persley says, yes, there is some consensus that there will be more demand for LNG early next decade. But it's impossible to say exactly when, and for the state to focus on that window may not make sense. And Persley says many LNG projects do bring in outside financing, but the sheer size of Alaska's project makes that approach daunting.
If you're looking at $30, $40, $50 billion of investment to go out and raise in the market for an LNG project, that would be the largest LNG project financing ever put together in the world.
Is the state capable of marshaling that kind of effort? That's the question raised by Anchorage Republican Kathy Giesel. Giesel chairs the Senate Resources Committee and is recovering from laryngitis.
The most obvious and first concern is how do we afford it? The secondary concern is who has the expertise to step into a greater role?
Giesel says neither the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation nor its citizen board have the experience to oversee a project like this. From what she understands so far, she says, she doubts the Senate would support the plan. But Giesel says the administration hasn't discussed it with lawmakers in any detail. As for the companies, Exxon, BP, and Conoco all replied to questions with brief emailed statements. Exxon and BP wouldn't discuss their negotiations with the state, but Conoco confirmed the administration has floated a state-controlled project, saying the company is having conversations to better understand the proposal. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage.
State government officials might be too optimistic about the market when planning to use money from the Alaska Permanent Fund to help pay for state government. That's what the chief executive officer of the corporation that manages the Alaska Permanent Fund told the editorial board of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner yesterday. A bill before lawmakers would take 5.25% of the market value, or about $2.5 billion, to help pay for state government. The fund's CEO, Angela Rodell, says she has concerns about the ability of the fund to keep up with that expectation year after year. The fund's trustees currently have a goal of a 5% return with an additional 2.25% for inflation. The fund hasn't met those goals recently because of the market. Lawmakers will reconvene in special session on July 11th in Juneau to take up the PFD bill and other revenue-generating measures to address the multi-billion dollar budget shortfall. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Juneau Assembly hears support for an anti-discrimination ordinance.
We belong here. Whether we are straight or gay, lesbian or transgender, we belong here.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and Alaska's communities and in operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
There's an administrative change ahead for veterans across Alaska who get benefits through the VA. A new director has been appointed to oversee the Portland and Anchorage offices in charge of benefits. William F. Streitberger is a Navy veteran and worked earlier in the VA's regional office in Hartford, Connecticut. In his new position, Streitberger is in charge of more than 400,000 former service members and dependents living in Oregon and Alaska, distributing about $20 million in monthly benefits within Alaska. Kylene Umel is a public affairs officer with the Veterans Benefits Administration in Portland and says even though administrative functions are based in Oregon, vets in Alaska receiving pensions, compensation, and vocational training won't see any sudden changes.
Our divisions there on site will still have face-to-face with our Alaskan veterans.
Portland was established as the regional benefits hub for Alaska's VA after a national reorganization in 2015. The regional office has been overseen by an acting director since last summer. Streitberger begins work on July 5th. Alaska State Troopers will extend their coverage of Girdwood through September 30th of this year. Troopers say this should give the community enough time to negotiate a contract with the Whittier Police Department. In the meantime, troopers will continue to provide services to Turnagain Arm communities. Troopers were previously slated to vacate the Girdwood post on July 1st. The Juneau Assembly heard nearly unanimous support for a proposed ordinance that would protect people from discrimination based on gender identity and sexual orientation. 30 people testified on the ordinance at the Juneau Assembly committee hearing yesterday, including Reverend Sue Belita of the Resurrection Lutheran Church.
We belong here. Whether we are straight or gay, lesbian or transgender, we belong here. We belong in our workplaces. We belong in our apartments and homes.
The proposed ordinance would create a new local equal rights law. Unlike the state's law, Juneau's would include gender identity and sexual orientation. It would protect the two classes from discrimination in local businesses, employment, education, housing, and public accommodations like hotels. The ordinance also includes some religious and tribal exemptions. People from the LGBT community, allies, local business people, and clergy shared personal stories in the hopes of highlighting its importance. The first to speak was Mark Hutter, who shared that he always felt welcome growing up in Juneau, but says he was recently fired from his job for being gay.
You can't make someone accept someone that is different than them, but you can provide protections for individuals like me who face discrimination when all we want to do is work hard and pay the bills.
More than 60 people crowded into the assembly chambers for the public hearing that lasted nearly 2 hours. Kristen Bomagen, who identifies as a lesbian, says she's lived in Juneau since the 80s. She focused her testimony on her experiences with housing discrimination.
The second eviction was from a 4-month sublet, And when I had occasion to complain about the noise from another neighbor, I was told, if you don't like it here, I don't want you here, I don't like your lifestyle. And I, of course, wanted to say, well, you can't do that, but she could, and she did, and she can do that today.
State law doesn't include sexual orientation or gender identity as protected classes, but cities continue to expand protections. If Juneau's ordinance passes, it will become the second city after Anchorage to provide discrimination protection for the LGBT community in housing, private employment, and businesses. For now, the Juneau Assembly members recommended clarifications to the ordinance's language, which will be discussed again next month. Nome's coast will get a little more crowded this summer, but it's not dredging or drilling that will add to the offshore activity.
We're not drilling for something, we're drilling a path for something.
That's Christina Wolston. She's vice president of external affairs for Quintillion, the company that is promising to bring high-speed internet to Western Alaska by 2017. Quintillion has been working onshore since March, laying the fiber optic cable that will help deliver that internet to Nome's more than 3,000 residents. Wolston says the offshore portion of the project will happen sooner than expected.
We actually are going to start a little bit early here in Nome than what we had thought because we have a vessel available and we also have some great open water.
The onshore cable will connect to the subsea cable just a few miles east of downtown Nome. Wolston says they chose that portion of the shoreline since it was free of gold dredging leases. Quintillion will begin work laying subsea fiber optic cable off Nome's coast the first week of July. Dr. Neil Hitch is the Museum of the Aleutians' new executive director. The museum's board of directors unanimously offered him the position last month, and he just signed his contract to begin work on August 15th. Susie Golodoff, chair of the board, says Hitch stood out from his cover letter.
He said, and I'll quote here, he says, "I have two core beliefs about museums. They should be engaged with and responsive to the needs of their communities, and they should be fun." And I think a lot of us felt such a sense of relief and excitement over that because it's kind of what we're looking for.
Golodoff says he has an amazing set of qualifications.
He's really good at stepping into a museum that's kind of got some challenges or is just getting started or has kind of been on hold and just picking it up and really making it shine.
Hitch has more than 20 years of museum experience from his current position as director of the Imperial Valley Desert Museum, a museum many believed would never open, to director of the Turks and Seo National Museum. Hiring a new executive director has been a long time coming. The museum has been shuttered all but a handful of days since the fall when the board placed former director Zoya Johnson on administrative leave after items from the museum's collection were found in her home. At this point, the board doesn't know when the museum will open its doors, but they plan to discuss that at their next meeting.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
The MBA program at Alaska Pacific University provides working professionals an educational pathway to career advancement. Through APU's hybrid course format of online and campus-based courses, students can focus on healthcare, finance, technology, and strategic leadership options. Apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
The Anchorage District Attorney will soon decide whether to file assault charges against the spokesman for the majority caucus of the Alaska House of Representatives. KTUU reports Will Vandergriff was arrested for felony assault after police say he was involved in an altercation with a woman at an Anchorage apartment late in the evening on June 12th. District Attorney Clint Campion tells the Associated Press that he needs more information on the case but expects to decide on charges within a week or so. An arraignment was scheduled for July 22nd. The 37-year-old Vandergriff was released on bail on June 13th. Attempts by the AP to reach him and House Speaker Mike Chenault on Tuesday weren't immediately successful, but Chenault told KTUU that he placed Vandergriff on administrative leave and will let the court process play out. The Native Corporation for the Southeast Village of Hoonah will soon have its first shareholder CEO. Hoonah Totem Board of Directors Chairman Russell Dick will become the corporation's CEO and president on October 1st. He'll take over from Larry Gaffney, who's held the top spot for 7 years. Gaffney, who is not a shareholder, says he's wanted to turn the reins over to a tribal member for years.
We've got a solid corporation, and we've got an absolutely qualified, energetic, enthusiastic guy to take the helm. So the time's absolutely right to do it.
Hoonah Totem has about 1,400 Tlingit shareholders with ties to Glacier Bay and Hoonah, about 40 miles southwest of Juneau. It employed about 110 shareholders last year. It's best known for its Icy Strait Point cruise ship attraction, which was built around a renovated cannery. Dick has been CEO of Sitka-based Alaska Dream Cruises for about 2.5 years. Before that, he ran Sea Alaska's Han Ani subsidiary, which focused on regional business development. He's also served as vice chairman of the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority Board since 2013. Dick wasn't available for immediate comment, but Gaffney says he grew up with Hoonah Totem.
He certainly understands this corporation and its people and its mission down to his bones. He's also got the requisite business experience to take it forward, and he's got the full support of the board.
Dick will be based at Hoonah Totem's corporate headquarters in Juneau. Gaffney says he will move on to another business opportunity after leaving the corporation, though he wouldn't discuss details. An ambitious plan to develop agricultural land west of Nenana is on hold until the town can find another $5 million to complete work to build a bridge across the Nenana River. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Jason Mayron scampers over a rock pile on the eastern bank of the Nenana River and points to a row of steel pilings hammered into the river bottom near the opposite bank about 400 feet away.
But this is the long span. This is the expensive span.
That's where work stopped last year on a project to build a 14-mile road to access lands west of the river for agricultural development. Mayrand is Nenana's mayor, and he and other local officials have for decades been pursuing the project, which he says would give a huge boost to the area's economy.
There's hundreds of thousands of acres of ag land out there. It's a lot of property.
Mayrand says Nenana spent about $3 million on the project for design and other preliminary work before getting $6.5 million in 2012 from a statewide transportation bond package. The money paid for improvements to the gravel road that leads to and from the river and construction of a small bridge across a nearby slough. But the mayor says the town ran out of money for the project last fall, soon after work began on a big bridge to span the main river channel.
You know, we had originally budgeted this project years before it got funded, and the expenses have slowly climbed up over time just due to the economy and some other things that have come up. You know, the price of fuel's gone up, the price of insurance has gone up, the price of materials has gone up, labor has gone up.
The mayor says it'll take another $5 million to finish the bridge.
We're still pursuing extra sources of funding to finish the project, but the state has no money, the Fed has no money. There aren't grant opportunities like there used to be, so we're doing the best that we can with what we have.
The bridge is part of the Totchocket Resource Development Corridor Access Project, which Nenana officials estimated would cost $17 million. Mayron says city officials requested only $6.5 million from the bond package because they'd been trying to keep costs low and because they assumed more funding would follow once the state started selling land opened up by the project.
We've had inquiries from even farmers in the lower 48 that have flown to Alaska to look at the land because they're interested in farming it.
A state agriculture division official who's been working with the city on the project since 2008 agrees there's still a lot of interest in the land, but Dan Prue says the state won't try to sell much of it until after the bridge is built.
With no bridge, it's going to really be hard to, you know, sell 40 or 50 lots or parcels, you know, encompassing 10,000 acres, the bridge goes in, you know, we can go have a much larger sale.
Prue says much of the area is unsurveyed and unappraised, and he says the state's fiscal crisis makes it unlikely it'll pay the costs of ferrying surveyors and appraisers into and out of the area by boat or aircraft.
So basically, the cost of preparing it is exponentially larger without a bridge.
Longtime Nenana area farmer Sven Ebbesen says he's seen this problem many times. He says it's one of the biggest obstacles to promoting the ag industry in Alaska.
One of the problems has been with agricultural parcels is that the land has been sold without developing the infrastructure that you need for farming, including access roads and so on.
Catherine Eldemar is director of the State Division of Community and Regional Affairs, and she agrees it's an all too common problem.
Well, it's like anything in Alaska. Building the infrastructure is something that is painfully neglected.
Eldemar also says it's unlikely the state will provide more funding for the bridge anytime soon, but she says her agency stands ready to help Nenana move ahead on the project. In Nenana, I'm Tim Ellis.
Fairbanks' annual Midnight Sun baseball game continues tonight after being suspended early this morning due to low light. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Runner goes from first.
The Alaska Gold Panthers are off to a strong start in the 111th edition of the Midnight Sun baseball game at Fairbanks Groudon Park. The home team is leading the Kenai Peninsula Oilers 8-0 through six innings in the suspended game.
They are delaying this game until 7 o'clock tomorrow night. They're calling the game because of darkness.
With six innings done and a team ahead, the game could have been considered complete. But as clouds blocked the midnight sun after 1 a.m., umpires and coaches instead opted to halt play for half an hour. And then when conditions didn't improve, rather than break tradition by turning on the stadium lights, delayed the remainder of the game until tonight.
Another odd chapter in this long history of the Solstice Classic.
The final three innings of the midnight sun game will be followed by a second game tonight at Groudon Park. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Rachel Waldholt, Zachariah Hughes, and Josh Edge in Anchorage, Lakeed Rashavis and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Emily Russell in Nome, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, and Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
GCI, serving more than 100 Alaska communities. GCI's Alaska Born and Raised campaign celebrates the people who call Alaska home. GCI.com/share your story.
And by
ExxonMobil Alaska, working with more than 100 Alaska communities and thousands of Alaskans. Today, ExxonMobil is producing natural gas condensate from the Point Thompson facilities. The University of Alaska Southeast specializes in you. UAS is a learning community where your professors or mentors and friends on campus and online. UAS.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.